We've saved the most sobering discussion for the last, terror in the name of God, and we have two of the leading people in the country on this, on the topic. You've seen from her bio Dr. Jessica Stern. Her PhD is from Harvard University. I hope you notice in her bio in the last paragraph it says she was included in Time Magazine series profiling 100 people with bold new ideas. The film The Peacemaker, starring Nicole Kidman and George Clooney, is based on a fictional account of her work at the National Security Council. So did Nicole Kidman play you? Yes, indeed. Congratulations. That's wonderful. But she also has written a very important book called Terror in the Name of God, Why Militants Kill. She has a new book out now called Denial, a Memoir of Terror. So when this topic came up at our advisor's lunch post-San Bernardino, I said, you know, the best person we could get would be Dr. Jessica Stern, and I was delighted when she said she could join us. So, Dr. Stern, thank you so much for being at this Faith Angle Forum on this very sobering topic. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad I finally got to come here. It's been a thrilling experience. And thank you all. I found the conversation really enlightening in all ways. So I think to begin with, I should try to define religious terrorism. What does that mean? What is terror in the name of God? I'll start by telling you how I would define terrorism, and that there's hundreds of definitions in the literature. For me, it's about violence or the threat of violence against non-combatants with the aim of influencing an audience, usually to change its policy. A central feature is that it is deliberately targeting non-combatants, which means that it's a violation of the Judeo-Christian just war tradition as well as the Islamic just war tradition by definition. However, it could, in fact often does, satisfy the jus ad bellum requirement. So it's always a violation of jus in bello, but it may be for a just cause. And that's important, I think, to remember. Unjust means possibly for a just cause. Who's the audience? Well, the audience are the people who sympathize with the victims. Right now, we are a big part of ISIS's audience. But it's also those who sympathize with the terrorists. And it's also the terrorists themselves. So I think that we need to see terrorism as partly solipsistic. It's not just about the enemy. It's about the perpetrators and those who sympathize with them. What makes it religious? And I see Jamie right across from me, and I know you're going to have some views. There are many ways to differentiate religious terrorists from non-religious terrorists. For me, it's about what they say. So while the IRA was of a different religion from its enemy, they didn't say that they were doing it for religious reasons. While many identity Christians, some Hindu nationalists, ISIS, right now, the group we're all talking about all the time, they say they're doing it for religious reasons. And so I put them in the category of religious terrorists, even though I'm going to try to persuade you that religion isn't critical to often their agenda, and it isn't necessarily critical to their recruitment drives. I've spent a lot of time talking to religious terrorists in Indonesia, Israel, India, Lebanon, Pakistan, and the United States. You should also realize there are Buddhist terrorists. Every religion produces terrorists. And I should say at the outset, I'm not an expert. I did also, my last book is actually on ISIS. No, it's called...
Muslims own all the crazies in the world.
I'm not an expert on Islamist terrorists. I'm certainly not an expert on Islam, and there are disadvantages to that. You know, certainly writing a book on ISIS, there are disadvantages to that. But there are also advantages, because I can see the tricks that religious terrorists play. And much of what ISIS does is similar to what identity Christians do. So that said, at this point in history, only the jihadis are able to recruit large numbers. This is a very popular ideology, not just among Muslims, but for those who've been arrested in the United States in connection with ISIS-related crimes, 40% are converts. So it is an ideology that is appealing, and that's something that we need to address. Why are jihadis so much more successful than, for example, identity Christians or the grandson of Meir Kahana in Israel, who thinks the Israeli government isn't Jewish and wants to destroy isn't Jewish enough and wants to destroy that government? Why are they flops in comparison with jihadis? I think the reason is what is happening in Muslim-majority states and the narrative of humiliation. Islamic civilization was once the greatest on earth, and Zawahiri and others have interpreted this as a source of humiliation and blame the West for that humiliation. And I believe the West is partly to blame, not only. Well, I don't blame it on us by any means, but I blame part of it on us. Let me just say a little bit about how I first came to study this phenomenon. The first religious terrorist I ever spent time with was an identity Christian. And I started emailing him, and I was asking him questions about his spirituality. He had just gotten out of prison. He had been involved in a cult that aimed to take down the Zionist-occupied government. This is the kind of group that we're going to see more of, I think, in the next few months. I think we're going to see more action on the part of these groups. He was actually surprised how interested I was in his spirituality, and I was very surprised by how spiritual he seemed. And he said that he joined a fellowship in rural Arkansas. It didn't start out violent. The leader had a revelation. They began preparing. They felt they were in the times of tribulation. They began preparing for the end times. They had an idea that if they carried out acts of violence against mud people, that the Messiah would return more quickly. So they actually felt they had an influence on the timing of the Messiah. What happens with these cults is that when they predict the timing of the apocalypse, when the apocalypse doesn't occur on the day they predict, they become more, they're strengthened in their expectation. They just assume it will happen at a later date. And there's a wonderful book, be recommending books just like David yesterday, but When Prophecy Fails, which it shows how when a number of groups, the apocalypse doesn't show up, and rather than leaving, people become stronger in their expectation. ISIS is also an apocalyptic cult. I'll say more about that later. The reason I say that ISIS is doing, I see ISIS doing the same thing. ISIS relies on Islamic texts. The president won't call jihadis Islamist. He certainly won't call them Muslim. I will. They are relying on these texts, but so did Kerry Noble, one of the leaders of this cult. And I said to him, Christians typically ascribe the qualities of light and love to God and try to manifest those qualities in their own lives. And he agreed. But the scriptures describe another aspect of God, he told me. The Lord God is a man of war. He's quoting, somebody will know where these come from. If I whet my glittering sword, I will render vengeance on my enemies. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh. So their hermeneutics are, I believe, dictated by apocalyptic expectation, and I think Rabbi Sacks would say a misreading of the text. I'm not qualified to say whether it's a misreading of the text. It's in the text. And ISIS is also, I'm not qualified to say that they're misreading the text. It's in the text, but it's a selective reading of the text. All these texts are filled with contradictions, and these guys find a way to focus on the parts of the text that justify what they want to do. And we only need to remember that abolitionists referred to the Bible to justify the abolition of slavery, and those who supported slavery also justified it but with reference to the text. So what about ISIS? ISIS sees itself as purifying Islam. Its actions are all explained with reference to texts. A good example is its reinstitution of slavery. That's how it refers to its use of sexual slavery. It calls the reinstitution of slavery a means for improving the moral life of its fighters and as a way to fulfill one of the signs of the hour, indicating the imminence of the end time. By sexually enslaving Yazidi girls, ISIS claims to believe that it's revivifying Islam, offering its followers a version of Islam that was practiced by the Salaf, the first three generations of Muslims or pious predecessors, which is unencumbered by hermeneutics or the accretions of historical practice. I think it's important for us to remember that at the time these texts were written, slavery was a common practice throughout the world. And of course, we can find reference to slavery in the Bible. I won't bother quoting for you, but I'm sure you know. Slavery, of course, is abolished throughout the world, but it's still practiced throughout the world. It's a billion-dollar business. And should we refer to the practice of slavery today as Christian or Jewish because some Christians and Jews are making money by through human trafficking? I don't think so. This is my view, and I realize that there will be other views in the room, and I look forward to the debate. I think it's also important, if you look at what ISIS says about slavery, I think it's important to realize that they inadvertently admit that it's instrumental. They say that they realize that some young men cannot afford wives and that they might be tempted to have sex with a family housemaid, and that therefore this is their way of allowing those young men, I think it's part of their recruitment strategy, to have sex. It's part of one of the incentives they offer without being forced to, well, have sex with a family maid or premarital sex this is not a sin, according to their scholars. But if you read closely, it really does look instrumental, as well as religious, their interpretation of religion. So what does ISIS want? It wants two very different and contradictory things. On the one hand, it wants to run its so-called caliphate in Iraq and Syria, now in Libya. It has provinces now in many parts of the world, in Egypt, in the Caucasus. It's in Afghanistan, in Libya, of course, in Saudi Arabia. It wants to run its state. It also likes to refer to itself as a state. But it also wants to goad the West into sending in ground forces for a final battle at Dabiq. And I have to say, when I first started looking at the apocalyptic narrative, I was really taken aback. I didn't expect that it would be as convoluted and well articulated as the Christian identity cult that I was talking about. The name of their online magazine, which I urge all of you to look at, if not read, is Dabiq. That's the name of the town where they want to fight out this final battle. D-A-B as in boy, I-Q. So these are clearly contradictory goals. And I've been troubled by this contradiction in studying ISIS. It's hard to figure out. This doesn't make sense. But there is one goal that ISIS is pursuing that would further both of these agendas, and that is to make Muslims in the West feel unsafe. They say they want to destroy the gray zone of moderate Islam. And for this reason, I do believe that Trump is falling into a trap. He is helping to destroy that gray zone. That does, in fact, if ISIS attacks in the West, it both goads us into attacking them, but it also is utilizing Muslims who live in the West, thereby helping to destroy that gray zone. Thereby, the more ISIS can increase prejudice against Muslims in the West, the more it can actually pursue both parts of its agenda. You should tell me when I should stop.
Don't worry, I will.
Okay. What's different about ISIS? For me, the best way to think about this is almost as a firm. ISIS, like most terrorist groups, aimed to succeed, has to attract capital, labor, and brand. What's wrong? Why are these other groups that I mentioned flops? They cannot attract capital. They cannot attract labor. Their narrative, their ideology is not appealing right now. And they don't have a good brand. ISIS is very good at all three. Where does it get capital? You know it gets capital from exporting oil. Who buys the oil? Well, Assad is one of the major consumers of that oil. The oil is getting through the Turkish border. A lot of people, as often happens in civil wars, are getting rich off this conflict. It's also exporting, selling Captagon and amphetamine. It's also using that amphetamine while it is fighting. It is taxing the sale of antiquities. It is taxing the sale of refugee flows. We would call it extortion. They call it taxing. Also, it earns a lot of money from extorting the population trapped on the territory it controls. So it needs territory, partly as a source of finances. What about its brand? This group is better than any group in history at branding itself. And it is very active, as I'm sure many of you know, on social media, but that's just how it spreads its branding and marketing. It also has a compelling narrative, and it also has it's very good at magazine layout, at filming. They have professionals who do these films. The films are stories. They're not just an old man droning on, which would be Zawahiri, who is very boring. Part of their brand is brutality. And they are following a recipe that dictates that brutality is a good way to polarize Muslim against Muslim, Sunni against Shiite, polarize the West against itself, and of course the West against Western governments against Muslim majority states. Labor. To attract labor, terrorists offer three kinds of incentives: spiritual incentives, emotional incentives, and financial incentives. And ISIS is, first of all, capitalizing on the disenfranchisement of Sunni Arabs in the territory it controls. And this is an area where I do believe the West has played a significant role. We fired all the Ba'athists. They suddenly found themselves without jobs, with weapons. Some of them spent time in U.S. detention facilities where Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, was busy creating a jihadi organization. The U.S. detention facilities in Iraq are a very important part of the story of how ISIS evolved into the group it is today. For foreign fighters, we've never seen a group this capable of attracting foreign fighters. There is the spiritual incentive, the opportunity to live in what ISIS calls the only Sharia-based state. There is the humanitarian incentive, the opportunity to help Syrians who are suffering. There's the attraction to violence. It seems impossible now that we wouldn't see psychopaths overrepresented in ISIS. That doesn't mean they're all psychopaths, by no means, but certainly some of the people joining would have to be attracted to violence. It's an opportunity to recreate oneself. I think that the narrative in some ways has things in common with what happened in the 60s and 70s. It's rather than make love, not war, it's make war, not love. It's a fad. It's a faddish narrative among young people. Fortunately, in the United States, it's not very faddish.
Why is that attractive?
Because of the level of frustration, especially in Muslim-majority states. I mean, I think that why is it attractive in the West? I mean, there are two different questions. Why is it attractive
I understand make love, not war, but I don't get make war, not love.
That's why you're not... and you're not the recruit they want.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but there are so many incredible studies showing the patterns of attraction to gangs in the United States and the attraction to terrorist organizations like ISIS. There's a almost very identical character traits and personal background and mental health situation.
Yeah. I think for those in the West, that is how we should understand it. I'm involved in a big study at Children's Hospital in Boston, and we've been interviewing Somali refugee youth, and we find a correlation between delinquency, including support for violent extremism, and trauma exposure, social marginalization, and mental health issues. Strong bonds inside the community as well as with the country are protective. Ignorance about Islam is hypothesis to make youth significantly more vulnerable. So I think we need to bear in mind that ISIS poses a threat mainly to the region, secondarily to the countries closer to the region, primarily to Muslims, and only at the bottom, the United States. The biggest threat to us is the lone wolf Western recruit who is very much like a kid who would join a gang. I have some ideas and some things we're doing to help address that, but I'm going to stop here because we can talk about that.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stern. Thank you very much.